So let's settle into our meditation posture. I'm just looking at some of the faces and people who have kept their video on, just seeing that you naturally find your way into your own practice. And so I will talk, but if you don't need me, just don't listen. Just hear it as sound. So letting the attention move into the body. And just feeling the body sitting. The meditation posture is one that's engaged. It's not a sleepy posture or a lazy posture. It's a posture that expresses presence and even curiosity, attention. And within that, we try to let go. Bring a quality of ease. Softening the belly, releasing the shoulders, relaxing the jaw, it's the sense of the whole body letting go. Feeling the breath moving in the body. Letting the thoughts just come and go. Returning to the breath. Not grasping at the breath or trying to have some microscopic experience of breathing, simply feeling the breath as part of the body. Aware too of feeling of mood or mind state. This is often something that's kind of subtle in the background, we might miss. Often, great influence in our thoughts. When we notice the mood, can help us to let go of the thoughts, to realize they are conditioned by those particular feelings that are present. The word feeling, we use that in Buddhist meditation, refers to this kind of meeting point of mind and body. It's a felt experience in the body, but it's expressing something more subtle than just a sensation. It's related to emotions, can be a manifestation of emotion. But it's more about just being pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. So instead of getting into a story about what we're feeling and all the causes and nuances of that, we just notice that's unpleasant. Or that's pleasant, or that's not pleasant or unpleasant. And this is one of the ways that our practice guides us towards the impersonal, moving away from the story and the self, just identifying the quality of experiences. And we try to bring a kind acceptance to whatever is arising, not grasping or pushing away. With that attitude, we see the transient nature of everything we feel. It's always in flux. It's always in flux and it's unstable. We don't have to sort of struggle with it because it's always going to move through sooner or later. So as the Buddha guides mindful breathing, it's to feel the breath with the body, feel the breath with the feelings, feel the breath with thoughts and mind states, feel the breath with impermanence. The breath is always our partner, always accompanies our experience, keeps us in our body, connected to our body, as we bring mindfulness to these other aspects of experience and insights. With the breath, we never get too far away from the present moment. All right. I thought I would spend some time tonight talking about the sutta that I've been writing about, and hopefully I can make some connections to recovery through that. I certainly think there are connections that. There's the sutta with the innocent sounding name of mindfulness of breathing, or anapanasati. And I've kind of taken it as I know some of you have heard me talk about this, maybe quite a bit about it, but I've taken it as a kind of a challenge to study it. And particularly through the lens of several different teachers. So there are several, you know, kind of classic books about the sutta. And so in a way, it's quite a, you know, maybe a bit of hubris to think I can contribute something to the conversation. But a lot of my approach to writing about it is to write about the difficulties of understanding what the Buddha said and trying to understand what he wanted us to do with this instruction, because it's really one of the most specific instructions on meditation in the early Buddhist tradition. So it's there are 16 steps within the sutta. Even calling them steps is something that one of the teachers I've been studying about this said it doesn't think that's a good term, because he doesn't think it's really a sequential process. So it's even difficult to talk. There are 16 different components to the sutta, and they are divided into four groups of four, which parallel the other sort of most important meditation sutta, which is the Satipatthana, which is the four foundations of mindfulness. So these four sections are about body and feeling, which I was talking about during the meditation, mind, which we'll talk a little bit about what that means, and then basically insights. And so it's really trying to give us this tool, in some broad sense, give us a tool for working with our human experience, working with our experiences of our body, working with the experiencing of our feelings, working with the experience of our mind, and then making some sense of that, having some wisdom, some insight about that. And of course, this is also, you know, when we talk about addiction, we talk about it as being a disease of the body, a mental disease, and a spiritual disease. So it's, it really is kind of, there is this kind of parallel to that. And I would say that when, you know, the addiction is also a disease of feelings, right? Emotion, it's an emotional or psychological disease. So the sutta sort of addresses all those things. And what kind of, as I come to understand the sutta, it's, you know, the idea of it being called mindfulness of breathing doesn't really at all capture what it's about. Each of the 16 steps includes the Buddha saying, you know, aware of, experiencing the in-breath, do this. Experiencing the out-breath, do this. So there's always the breath with your experience, which is one of the translations of the title is from Buddhadasa Bhikkhu, is instead of calling it mindfulness of breathing, mindfulness with breathing. So it starts out, the beginning of the sutta is just being aware of the breath. The first two steps are just being aware of the long breath and the short breath, as it says, which in and of itself is a confusing instruction, but we'll put that aside for now. And then it says, being aware of the breath, be aware of the whole body as well. And then being aware of the breath, calming the body. And it's not so much that we're supposed to, well, let me breathe and calm my body. It's rather that if we pay attention to the breath, we will, and just stay with it consistently, you know, if we can get somewhat concentrated, we'll notice that the body starts to become more calm, right? It's like, oh, this is sort of a natural process that we're involved in. But I would say that we can also sort of guide that process, nudge that process along, right? We do intentionally use the breath to calm down. When we say to someone, just take a breath, we're saying to them, you know, breathe and relax. And many times we hear instructions about that too, you know, releasing with the breath, you know, and when you do yoga, you know, breathing into a posture, right, which is about relaxing the body intentionally with the breath. So there's this beginning stage of just kind of connecting with the breath and then using the breath to really help you settle. And, you know, this is as much as many of us do in our meditation, just working that far into the sutta, the first section, to just get with the breath and calm the body. That's a lot right there. So the second of the four sections, starts by, and this is where the questions really start to arise. It says, you know, breathing in, experiencing rapture. Breathing out, experiencing rapture. And you kind of go, really? What? am I experiencing rapture right now? I'm not sure. Breathing in, experiencing happiness or joy. Breathing out, experiencing joy. And so this is kind of suggesting that if we really settle the mind, and if we really settle the body, I probably should say, with the breath, that some pleasant feelings will come up. And they have these terms for them in the sutta, but I think sometimes the language, you know, rapture or joy, can get in the way of just experiencing the pleasant nature of a calm body and the mind becoming calm, you know. So, and if you're familiar with Thich Nhat Hanh, this will sort of have some echoes of him. And he's one of the teachers whose books I'm reading and talking about in this, in my own writing. Because he had, you know, famously has a guided meditation in which he suggests that we smile, you know? And so there is this way in which if we kind of quiet down and get calm and focused, that we can notice the pleasant nature of that experience. And I do think this gets overlooked a lot in meditation, oftentimes because I think we do get stuck in the early stages. You know, it is hard to just get to the point where you're calming the body and where you're really with the breath, you know, because most of us have pretty busy minds and we can get very agitated. But it can also be helpful when we notice that things are starting to settle, to kind of turn the attention toward, oh, is there a pleasant aspect of this present moment experience? So without going through the, I'm not sure I want to go through the whole sutta, but this brings up something that I was looking at today, which was from Ajahn Pasano, another one of the teachers I'm referencing and kind of studying here, at a later stage in the sutta, but it applies really in many parts, which is him saying that instead of looking at the disturbances of the mind, look at the inner or innate stillness. Maybe I can find that little piece that he has. Or maybe I can't. I don't know. Let me see. I'm going to look at what I was writing today. So he says that a lot of times we get in our meditation, we'll get into trying to get rid of the hindrances, or trying to get rid of, like, greed, hatred, and delusion, or how do I get rid of myself? But instead, it's possible to turn towards, is there something else there? You know, is there something else besides these agitations that are in the mind? I think this is a really valuable way to approach our practice. When we're sitting and it feels like, oh, there's a lot going on, I'm a really busy mind, and looking for the stillness. And one of the ways to kind of connect with that is just to feel the stillness of the body. You know, if you're sitting still, you can just experience stillness. And you might notice, oh, my mind is not still right now, but my body is. So let me just be with that stillness. And it's the same way that the breath, too, is this simple experience. I was talking about the other day about how one of the useful things about the breath is that it's a neutral experience. It doesn't trigger craving or aversion. It's not terribly pleasant, typically, but it's typically not unpleasant either. And so when we're with it, it's like this stillness of the body. It's just kind of there. It's very simple. It's empty of any sort of pull. So we can look for these things intentionally. And it's not that we're trying to suppress or get rid of the other things, but we're realizing that the totality of our experience is not the agitation. You know, the hindrances or the greed, hatred, and delusion are not the totality of our experience. And so it's possible to shift attention. You know, one of the things that is sometimes suggested when there's pain in the body is to look for the place in the body where there isn't pain. And it's kind of the same thing with the mind, right? You know, your back is hurting. Okay, you feel that. It's not that you're trying to get away from it, but just, okay, that's there. But how does my foot feel? How does my hand feel? You know, is there some other experience going on that I can turn my attention to? Because so much of our practice is about where do we direct our attention. And, you know, and I confess that I'm, you know, as much a, you know, get caught in this as anyone in focusing on the negative, focusing on the painful, focusing on the difficult. But it is really a helpful sort of guideline to say, oh, is there something pleasant here? And again, not that we're trying to suppress, not in an addictive way, like I got to get the good stuff now, get rid of that. No, but just to say, oh, I'm allowing the unpleasant, but let me also be aware of the pleasant. So in the sutta, what the the second section is about the feeling, the felt sense, and seeing how the feelings appear in the mind. So it starts, the second section starts by noticing the, you know, joy and happiness or rapture, and then it says to be aware of mental activity, or sort of the surface noise of the mind, not the thoughts themselves, but sort of the energetic aspect of them, which is also a really helpful way to practice. Because the fourth step then is calming that energetic aspect of the mind. And so we notice then in the sutta that there are these parallels, that the first section is about the breath and the body and calming the body. Second section is about feelings and the mind, or mental energy, and calming that energy. So there's this whole process where we're working on these different aspects of experience to kind of let them coalesce and become calm, the body, the energies, the feelings. The third section, which is mind, goes through something, you know, it gets, you know, some of the language of it is, I think, confusing, but it's first sort of seeing, okay, what's there? Mindfulness of the mind, and then looking again for the positive aspect of it, and then seeing the concentration developing. So here, a lot of these experts that I'm reading point to the idea that concentration actually arises out of joy. And this is another, maybe not intuitive idea, but I think it makes sense once we look at it, that in order for concentration to develop, for the mind to really become peaceful, we need to feel at ease in a certain kind of, when we say joy, it's not like we're rah-rah exclamation point joy, but rather the same kind of peacefulness and calm that arises when we settle into a focused and comfortable meditation. And so the body needs to become calm and comfortable, the feelings, the energetic feeling needs to become calm and comfortable, and then the mind state needs to become calm and comfortable. So we can see that this is all then building towards this fourth section about insight. So it's saying that in order to develop insight, the really profound insight into impermanence, that we need to have a very settled mind and body. And that's then what the fourth section is about, impermanence and finally letting go. So it's a very intriguing, you know, I'm calling what I'm writing, and I don't know if this is ever going to be published because it is so difficult, but I'm calling what I'm writing Wrestling with the Buddha, because that's what it feels like, you know. It feels like I'm wrestling with his teachings. Like, I remember first being exposed to the sutta and thinking, oh yeah, okay, sure, that makes sense. But then the more I looked at it in detail, the more I was like, yeah, but what does that mean? Wait, what? Am I supposed to gladdening the mind? How do I gladden my mind? You know, feeling rapture? Am I feeling? How do I do that? And then, you know, and I've had experiences of gladdening my mind and feeling rapture in meditation. So it's not that those things are alien. But it sort of is a question of, how am I supposed to make those happen, you know? And am I supposed to do it? And what part do I have in, like, efforting? And how much of this is just sort of a process? And again, something many of you have heard me say is that, you know, a lot of this development in our meditation really depends first on time, on sustained practice. And it's why retreats are so important. You know, when we sit down and we meditate for 20 minutes together, we can't expect that much to happen. You know, there are 16 stages in this Anapanasati Sutta. We can't expect ourselves to go through these 16 stages. Rapture, joy, gladdening, letting go, impermanence. Like, you know, it takes at least a week to even get there, a week of silent practice. Probably a month would be better. And maybe 6 months, you could really think, okay, I've got it. I wouldn't know. I've never done 6 months. So I've done a couple months. And it's really puts up this challenge. And so that then comes back to one of my central questions with this sutta is, how can I use this, or can I even use this, outside of the context of a long meditation period of retreat? Is there a way in which I can use these different pieces and draw upon it in 20 minutes or, you know, maybe a little longer, 45 minutes, an hour? And so I don't know if I'm going to answer that question exactly. But I will say that I believe it is possible to tap into some of these things, and that they are great sort of signposts and guides for us to look for in our practice, and indeed to try to evoke, and even in our lives. You know, certainly the insights into impermanence are something that go far beyond the meditation cushion, you know. And awareness of these different states, of whatever the states are, and the sutta points to very positive states, but I don't think that this is, again, sort of part of my argument that we can use the framework of the sutta, body, feelings, mind, insights, to look at any experience. So mindfulness of unpleasant feelings rather than just pleasant feelings. Mindfulness of, you know, unhappy mind rather than the happy mind, you know. So this is how I'm kind of drawing from this sutta and what I'm trying to bring out of it. The suggestion that we can apply this mindfulness to all the whole range of body, mind states that arise. You know, because this is what we need in our lives, in our recovery, in our just ordinary lives, is we need a way to hold each moment of life in its myriad ways of unfolding. You know, if our practice only allows us to focus on, you know, rapture and calm, then what do we do when we're not rapturous and calm? Do we just say, oh, well, I can't apply mindfulness to this experience because it doesn't fit into the sutta? Of course, that's silly, you know. So it's this is the challenge to me, is to sort of hold these different ways of viewing this sutta. And I am trying to take this sutta as the guiding teaching of my life right now, and kind of keep saying, okay, how can I bring this teaching into this moment? And finally, I will say that one of the things that working with it has done is it has made me much more aware of my breath throughout the day. This is one of the things that I've always known you know, I've always known that's like part of the practice. And particularly when you read Thich Nhat Hanh, you see how that's for him, that's it. You know, he says when he discovered this sutta, he felt that like he had discovered the greatest treasure in the world. And we can see from his teaching that this is the foundation of everything that he taught. But in my effort to be a beginner, you know, to practice beginner's mind, this is how I'm trying to, I have returned to this kind of beginning principle, which is by no means something that we ever get past, or we are meant to get past as practitioners. Thich Nhat Hanh said that when he wrote that book, the book on mindfulness of breathing, said, "I've been practicing mindful breathing for 50 years," and it was clear that he didn't mean just when he was meditating, but really in his life. So it's a great gift and a great practice. So I hope that's helpful. We have a little time left. If anybody wants to ask any questions or make any comments, thank you. Showing up in your chat right now is the Donna information, that's the supporting my teaching, as well as the information about our contact list. So,
Kevin, you mentioned that there's some really well-known books or books that you like about the Anna Anasati.
Yeah.
Can you recommend a couple until your book comes out, of course?
Thank you for that. I was going to say, you know, I don't want everybody reading out. No, of course. So it's really four books that I've been working with. One is by Venerable Inalio. And that one is just called Mindfulness of Breathing. And then one is by Buddhadasa Bhikkhu. And that one's called Mindfulness with Breathing. And then Thich Nhat Hanh. And his is called Breathe, You Are Alive. And then a short book by Ajahn Pasano. And that one's called Nourishing the Roots. And then I've been also working with Bhikkhu Bodhi's recordings. He has recordings on the suttas that are accessible. You can find on the internet. He has 4 hours of talks on the Anapanasati Sutta. I was actually watching recordings as well. I was watching last night. And there's another well-known book called Breath by Breath by Larry Rosenberg. But that's more of along the lines of what I'm doing, whereas these books are really like just about the sutta. And I also kind of, I'm sort of limiting myself. There's probably more out there, but these are teachers who I either have known or sat with or studied for, you know, and I feel like I have a relationship with them for many years. And so they're just four people that I really trust. Well, five, I should say, because Bhikkhu Bodhi is definitely in there.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Yeah, and if I were going to recommend one Well, I don't know. I wouldn't. They're all different. That's the thing. That's why. That's what's particularly interesting about this process of what I'm doing is I'll read one of them. For any one of the 16 steps, I'll read all of them, and then I'll see that they'll have very different takes on that step, right? And so then I'm kind of writing about their different takes, and I'm just kind of, to some extent, just recording, well, this person says this, this person says that, and then I kind of put in my own thoughts about it, right? And what appeals to me, or what I find confusing, or what I think is contradictory, or it's so that's I'm doing this kind of dance with them all, which is for me very interesting. The Ajahn Pasano one, which is called Nourishing the Roots, is something you can get online for free. You can download, and it's just a short chapter in a book. So if you want to get to it, just like get a quick that summary, that's a really good place to start. The others are books that are full books that are just about the sutta. This is a just based on a talk of his. And actually that was kind of my starting point. And that's probably the most accessible one. There you go. Thank you, Angela. She just put the link in there. You're a star. And it's just one chapter out of a short book. And it really, that's the one that I kind of started with. I had that with me on a self-retreat last December. And just for a week, I just worked with that. And I just would keep going back to it and looking at the different steps in it. And then I just kind of got really intrigued because I was looking at the sutta and I was like, wait, what? What's this? And then started to read the others. And then I was like, oh, this is really quite a labyrinth of ideas. What is a self-retreat? That's a good question. Self-retreat is when you go on a silent retreat, but there's nobody else there. So a typical Buddhist retreat is, a communal experience where, there's, a group, it could be 10, could be 100 other people, and a teacher or a group of teachers, and they give you your schedule, and they ring bells for you, and then the meals are served for you, and everything is very structured. It's great, because it really helps you to keep your practice together, because it's like, okay, this is what we suggest. Right now, meditate for 45 minutes. Okay, we ring a bell. Now, what do walking meditation for 45 minutes. Okay, now we're going to give you a talk. Okay, now's your lunch. Go eat lunch. And it's very structured. Every minute from morning till night is structured. And so I've started doing those kind of retreats 42 years ago, and don't eat the lunch. What? That's a strange thing to say. I've, there are times when either there isn't a retreat scheduled, or I can't find a teacher I want to sit with, or it doesn't fit with my schedule, or I just want to work on my own practice. And because I've done dozens of group retreats, I know the routine, and I'm very comfortable just going. I the last couple of retreats, I rented an Airbnb in a place called Sea Ranch up on the Northern California coast. I took along food, and I just would get up in the morning, meditate for an hour, make some breakfast, go for a walk, come back, meditate, walk, eat, walk, just follow, basically like a regular group retreat. So that is a self-retreat. Yes, John, why are you suggesting don't eat the lunch? You can't hide from us.
You don't want to spoil yourself on all the good food, I guess, is what
Okay.
I'll.
So you're recommending fasting on retreat. Well, Spirit Rock definitely has great food, you know.
Yes, some places
not as great.
And others, I'll say that.
Places not to be named. Yeah. Well, I'm heading out to Southern Dharma next week, and they are known for their fabulous food, so I'll be getting some of that. Yeah, self-retreat is great. You need to have a few residential retreats under your belt, I think, in order to really be confident that you're going to be able to maintain the structure. Because, first of all, you're not, you know, you're avoiding all, you know, internet, television, and pretty much you're not reading, you know, for entertainment. When I go on self-retreat, I take along some Dharma to study, but I'm not just hanging out like, oh, I'll just kick back and read a novel. There's a lot of renunciation involved in a retreat, you know. You're not calling anybody on the phone or checking your email. And that's hard to do when you're alone. I have failed at that once or twice, I will say, and really regretted it because it's not good to mix email with a silent retreat. Speaking from having had a very bad experience with that 10 years ago. Wow, that was 10 years ago. Wow. So, kids, nice to see everybody. I'll be back here Tuesday, and I will be around Friday. Going to have a couple of subs part of September, and I'll be here when I can in September as I travel around the eastern and middle western sections of the United States of America, trying to bring sanity to our country. Good luck. Thank you all for showing up and for being here for yourself and for the community. Be well.